Mr. Bull certainly summed things up for us this morning, didn't he? As only he can do. And I've got a short message. I want to leave something with you this afternoon. What I want to do in the message is to review a bit of history regarding the Days of Unleavened Bread, and I want to look at our responsibility beyond this festival that will end a few hours from now. And that responsibility is growing and changing. And the sermon title is Spiritually Growing Beyond the Days of Unleavened Bread. And you know, it's interesting when you look at all of the of our many detractors that we have, and there are many, most I guess, that minimize our observance of the Days of Unleavened Bread because they don't realize and they don't understand and they don't make any attempt to search it out for themselves and to find out just exactly when were these days instituted? Where did they come from? Oh, it's some Jewish thing. No, it's not. And that's easy to prove. Because there had to be a beginning that we can refer to. The festival of unleavened bread was commanded before the old covenant was made. A lot of people don't understand that. It was not a part of the law of Moses given nearly a year after the Israelites arrived at Mount Sinai. Now, what do we conclude from that? Well, it's quite obvious. Quite obvious. And what would our detractors say? What do those in Protestant land say? Those things we don't need to keep. Doesn't matter. What was instituted by the old covenant or the law of Moses was not, you know, what was not instituted, sorry, it was not instituted by the old covenant or the law of Moses was not done away when they ceased. Because these laws, these days were instituted long before that. Long before that. God did not give Israel sacrifices or burnt offerings to contend with when they came out of Egypt, did he? Let's notice that in Jeremiah chapter 7. Let's see what he did give them, what he did expect from them, and what he expects from us today. Jeremiah chapter 7, and beginning here in verse 22. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices, but this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but followed the counsels and the dictates of their evil hearts and went backward and not forward. We've been commanded today to go forward in these days. Verse 25. Since the day that your fathers came out of the land of Egypt until this day, I have even sent to you all my servants, the prophets, daily rising up early and sending them. Yet they did not obey me or incline their ear, but stiffened their neck, they did worse than their fathers. Therefore you shall speak all these words to them, but they will not obey you. Mr. Armstrong spoke and preached and taught for years and years and decades. Did they listen to him? No. You shall also call to them, but they will not answer you. So you shall say to them, this is a nation that does not obey the voice of the Lord their God, nor receive correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. What he commanded them to do was to obey, to keep the feasts, to keep his laws. But of course, one thing he did give everybody an out. Yeah, he did that. He said, you really only have to keep them for a very limited period of time. Isn't that what he said? No, not, as they would say. Turn to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 17. So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt, or your hosts, your numbers, out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, You shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. How do they say now, forget about it, doesn't matter, been done away with? You can't justify that statement. And each family had a very important responsibility to explain to their children what the festival means. Notice over in Exodus chapter 13, in verse 6, just over the page. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Verse 7 of Exodus 13. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand, as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand the Lord has delivered you or brought you up out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance till it's in its season from year to year. Year to year. Forever and ever. Teach it to your children. Never lose sight of it. Always have it in focus. What does it mean? And we do that in the church today. We teach our children what these days mean. And I was just wondering, how do they out there in Protestant land explain the resurrection and eggs, candy eggs? I try and put that together for me, please. It doesn't compute. That's another story. Let's point out something else to our detractors. Notice Acts chapter 12. Acts chapter 12. Some of these scriptures are good to keep in mind when you're getting involved in perhaps the occasion to talk to people about these things. After Christ was crucified, buried, and resurrected, the disciples knew they were expected to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Acts chapter 12, notice in verse 3. Talking here about Herod, who was out there to harass the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. In verse 3, because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Now, it was during the days of unleavened bread. So when he had arrested him, put him in prison, and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. Why should Luke, years after the crucifixion, use the Feast of Unleavened Bread to indicate the time of Peter's imprisonment? Why? Because Christians were still keeping this annual festival. That's why. That's why it's been recorded here. It wasn't somehow done away with. And a memo to all those in Protestant land, Jesus Christ kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in case you didn't know. We could look at some of those scriptures. We don't have to do that. Back in Egypt, Moses had to choose, didn't he? He had to choose between the sins of Egypt or serving God. And he was willing to forsake the practices of sin, and we are expected to do the same thing. We're expected to make a decision, make a choice, a conscious choice, and then put some effort into whatever that choice is. Hebrews chapter 12. God commands us to strive to expend energy and to put sin out of our lives. That's what these days are teaching us and should be teaching us as we move forward, as we go beyond these days. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. Nothing easy in that verse, is there? Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him He endured the cross, he despised the shame, and was sat down, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Verse 4. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. We haven't probably put that much effort into it, or had to deal with it in the same way, obviously, that Christ had to deal with it in terms of how he sweated blood, if you will, when he was praying, knowing what he was going to have to face. And you know, yesterday we were visiting a lady, and this interesting comment she made in a nursing home and in another fellowship, but a wonderful lady we've known for years. And sharpest attack in her late 70s, early 80s, determined to do the right thing, to serve and obey God. And she said, with her son who's gone off on a tangent somewhere and some of the unfortunate things in her life, and she said, I've been praying and asking God to give me a compass so we can find our way. I thought, what a beautiful way to put it. And I was telling Eileen, we were talking about on the way up here, and she said she thought about that as well. And she was saying that the compass for her and for us should be Mr. Armstrong. And it's so true. I mean, we talk about the foundation. We talk about what God did through him. But I love that word. It really fits. That's our compass. And that makes it easy then to know what to follow. She's a dear old soul. She had her Bible beside her by her dresser, and she had a box of matzos. So she has those every day. Yeah, a wonderful woman. And you know, brother, today is the last service on the last day of unleavened bread. Hooray! Bring on the leaven! Well, of bread maybe and cakes later on tonight, but not the leaven of sin that does so easily beset us. It's like Mr. Spellman said, you know, the Egypt in us is still there as of tonight. But the idea now is to keep it away, to keep it out, and to really concentrate, put some effort into it, and get a renewed charge. We've renewed our commitment at Passover. Now we're gonna renew our efforts and learn from these days and really go forward and make something of this next year. The point is, we cannot be idle Christians. We can't be idle Christians when these days are concluded a few hours from now. We can't say, yep, made it through another one. Whew, that's going to be over in a few hours. I hope we don't ever say that. We have to be busy growing spiritually, because there is nothing monotonous about the Christian life, is there? There's nothing ho-hum about living this Christian life. It's dynamic. Just as there is nothing monotonous about the biblical personalities that we can look at. And there are so many with their stories reserved for us. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as an example. They were not pretending church when they stood before the fiery furnace. They were growing spiritually in the face of death. And it doesn't get any tougher than that. They said, we will not bow to your golden image no matter what God decides to do. They did not fade in the face of adversity. They grew, and they went forward. And so must we. Constantly moving forward, never shrinking back. Because the adversary wants us to stop and to give up. And we've known so many people that have given up. And our adversary, Satan the devil, loves that. He loves to see that. And he wants you to stop. He wants me to stop. You know, someone might say, well, how can I possibly grow? How can I possibly move forward under my circumstances? Does a Christian grow under adversity? Ask you that question. Does a Christian grow under adversity? Can a person grow under adversity? Should a person grow under adversity, or should he or she just endure until the adversity is over? I'm just going to ride this storm out, leave things exactly as they are. Well, the answer is obvious. You see, growth's the name of the game, and you don't grow until you're under pressure. When things are easy, how much spiritual growth is really maintained or developed? Not a whole lot, I don't think. I don't think so. In athletic and sporting terms, they say, no gain without pain. And it is so true. Christian growth includes all types of pain. And no one can escape the process. Nobody. We simply cannot become the people God meant us to be without heartaches and without headaches. The Apostle Paul tells us that even Christ learned obedience from the things that he suffered for us. And that the long road that we're on from human to the spiritual, from mortal to immortal, is not an easy downhill slide. It is rather a challenge that forces us to look to God. We talk about children having growing pains. You know, all of our kids, and they say, you know, they go through one stage. Oh, I'm glad that stage is over. They're not wet in the bed anymore. Then they move into another with even more problems, especially as they get older. So it is with the Christian life. You know, we experience growing pains. We do. We go through one stage only to enter another. And I think there are a number of reference points to consider as we renew and as we grow beyond the days of unleavened bread. First reference I have down here is we grow through waiting. Now, has this guy gone balmy? How do you grow through waiting? Huh? Is that possible? How is it possible? Well, let's remember some very ordinary people who became spiritual giants because they chose to wait on God. Remember the story of Noah? You really have to go back and study these stories and think about it in real terms as human beings, not just in that, you know, he's building an ark and he's in the desert. Yeah, that's great. And you move on to something else. I mean, there's in between those verses, years go by. Years. You know, Noah out there, God told him to build the ark. And he endured ridicule. He endured scorn for years and years and years. And I'm sure there were times when he must have experienced just a little doubt as to what is going on here. You can't tell me he didn't, because he was as human as you and me. You know, it's been 57 years. I wonder when I don't see any rain. Noah waited 120 years for the rain. I call that waiting, gang. I really do. What about Abraham? You know, he's 75 years old, but he believed God's promise to make his descendants a great nation, but he didn't have a son to leave it to. How is this possible? We're getting a bit on in age. It's a wee bit beyond child-rearing here and child-bearing for my wife and me. How's this going to happen? You know, that's putting it in very human terms, because that's what I'm sure what he thought he would have to have been like that. And he was. When he was 100 years old, you know, his son was born. He had to wait. Who likes to wait? You want to wait for good things to happen? No, you don't. You want it now. I don't want to wait for my new car for another 5 years and keep old Betsy on the road. Then there was Joseph. Remember Joseph? 14 years inside a prison cell, waiting for God to deliver him. 14 years. I didn't deserve this. After the first month, I would have said, let me out of here. This has been great. I learned a lot, but I want to go home. 14 years. And there was Moses and Christ himself, all willing to wait on God for deliverance. Now, did you notice there's one startling similarity that all those individuals shared? Waiting on God was the rule, not the exception. Should it be any different for you and me? I've been asking God for years to do such and such, to heal this, to solve that, to help out here. Hasn't happened yet. Well, you haven't waited 120 years. Like Noah. See, the natural tendency for humans is to make waiting on God the exception, and then trusting in our own human wisdom. It's like that old saying that when there are no doors, force open the locks. That's something I probably would have done in my younger, foolish days. You know, in many areas of our lives, waiting will be the very process God uses to mature us. That's the point. Another observation in this regard, waiting on God is resting, not worrying. The difference between waiting and worrying about things is focus. How easy it is to use that term. We all, just have focus. Believe me, I know it's not easy. I'm not suggesting it is, but we have to have it. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31. He says, but those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be faint, or not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. We're going to wait on God to solve our problems, deal with our issues, give us that strength, and we're going to renew our strength. That's what we're doing here at this feast. We're renewing our commitment. We're renewing our dedication. We're renewing our strength. We're renewing our commitment to go forward. David understood what it was like to wait for God. Notice Psalm chapter 62. And he gives some encouragement here for other waiters. Yeah, we're all waiters. All of us are. Psalm 62. Verse 1, truly, my soul silently waits for God. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Verse 5, my soul waits silently for God alone, for my expectation is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation. We sing this psalm, don't we, quite often. He is my rock and my salvation, verse 6. He's my defense. I shall not be moved. In God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, you people, and pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. David here tells us what to do. He says, wait for God to direct your steps and trust God to provide your needs. And so often you read where David waited in silence, or he had to wait on the run or on his own. Maybe some of you feel that way right now. You're on your own. I'm waiting for God to show me, to guide me, to direct me, to give me strength. I need the help. I'm sure some of you are. But David says to wait in stability and confidence, not wavering. Verse 6, he alone is my rock and my salvation. He's my defense. I shall not be moved. And Psalm 62 clearly shows the fruits that come from waiting on God, and deliverance is one of them. He will deliver me. Verse 2 talks about security. And God being our stronghold. Verse 5, he's our hope. Verse 7 talks about being our refuge. Sometimes we sell God short in his ability to help us because we have the wrong focus. You know, a student once asked a teacher in the class going through this very difficult course, and the student said, is there a different avenue here, teach, that I can take that's shorter than the one that's prescribed in the course? And the teacher said, you bet. No problem. It depends on what you want to be. Okay, depends on what you want to accomplish. There's no shortcuts, is what he's saying. And there's no shortcuts to spiritual maturity. There's no quick fix. No, there's not. There isn't. You see, brethren, when God wants to make an oak tree, how long does it take? Oh, 50, 100 years? Something like that. When he wants to make a watermelon, it only takes a couple of months. You know? So the question before the court is, do you want to be an oak tree or a watermelon? I mean, I just thought of that now. That's hilarious. No, I don't want to be a watermelon. I don't even like watermelon. How often have we said, is there a shorter, less difficult route I can take? Let me see your hands if you've never said that before, and I won't expect to see one. Because there won't be any, if you're being honest. But it is only by waiting that our spiritual roots will go deep enough for us to become as solid as an oak tree. Verse 8 here, it says, trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. You see, waiting involves trusting, and waiting includes praying, or pouring out your heart before him. That's praying. And David, you know, you can read the story of David. He grew tremendously through waiting. And so can we. Because you know what, brethren? We're going to have to. We have to wait. We have to wait. You know, this woman we visited, she says, I'm waiting for my change. I'm waiting for my change. My body's not well. She said, I don't know how long I'm going to be around. I need help sometimes with my breathing. She said, I'm waiting for my change. And she said it very positively. That's what she's looking forward to. And we're going to have to wait for our change. And another area that is fertile ground for growth for you and me is one we may not recognize, and probably one you wouldn't actually put down. If I asked you to list four or five areas like we're doing here, 10 to 1, you probably wouldn't even mention this one. It is growing through failure. You might not put that one down. It's like the Microsoft Corporation. We heard this morning about in the offertory sermonette, the owner of Microsoft, Bill Gates, is worth, you know, billions and gives away billions and all the rest of it. And that company makes a lot of money. And there was an executive at Microsoft some years ago that lost the company $3 to $5 million by overlooking some detail in his department, which he should not have overlooked. Because you're talking big money and things like that. He was called up on the carpet and had a meeting with the vice presidents. There was more than one. They talked about it, explained it. And they sat back and said, you think this is ever going to happen again? He said, no, sir. No, sir. Never. And they said, you know what? We believe you. That's why we're going to keep you on. Because that failure will, in the long run, make you more successful and save the company more money in the years to come. I wonder how many people would have looked at it that way. But you grow through mistakes. You grow through mistakes. I grow through mistakes. I don't want to make mistakes any more than you do. But we make them. What makes it possible for personal growth to rise up out of a failed marriage, job difficulties, serious illness? Yeah, our response, that's what. That's what can make success out of those kind of failures, our response. Notice Psalm 103. Psalm 103. And your reaction and my reaction to failure of any sort is your responsibility and it's my responsibility. And David said you got to get your eyes properly fixed on the right goal. Psalm 103, in verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. And next, he reminds us we can claim God's promises. We went through some of this during the Passover. Verse 3, who forgives all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from destruction, who crowns you with loving kindness and tender mercies. In verse 10, and he has not dealt with us, nor will he keep his, not dealt with us according to our sins, nor punished us according to our iniquities. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. And when the things that we count on fail, when the things that we count on for security fail, such as a job, a relationship, a life's dream, something that just went up in smoke, whatever it might be, David points to the only kind of security that will never let us down. Verse 13. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame, and he remembers that we are dust. Verse 17. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to such as keep his covenant, and to those who remember his commandments to do them. And here we are obeying God, and keeping, commemorating, obeying, being submissive to Days of Unleavened Bread, much to the scorn and the ridicule of our many detractors who know nothing about it. You see, brethren, God can bring good out of failure if we continue to obey. And you know, somebody could have been standing around the crucifixion area during that time, one or two or a few of the many people that were there, saw all that had taken place, looked at Christ up on the cross, and can recall being around him when he fed the 5,000, took the few loaves and the few fish, saw him heal lepers, saw him do all sorts of fantastic miracles, heard his preaching and teaching, were enthused and were encouraged by it, perhaps. And they could look and they could say, well, he failed. Look, I'm sure some people said that. The bigger purpose was obscured by a limited human viewpoint. God can bring success, and we can grow through our failures. It depends on our focus. I don't want to grow through making mistakes any more than you do, and failures. Well, that's another area, growing through mistakes. I don't want to make mistakes, but I make all kinds of them. Growing through mistakes. Today, the word mistakes has many different meanings. You know, some see it as synonymous with sin. And others might call mistakes experiences. And certain celebrities in Hollywood, they like to categorize all their mistakes and call them memoirs. You know, My 13 Husbands by Elizabeth Taylor, or whatever number they've had, whatever. In Scripture, there are categories of mistakes listed. And one of them involved Abraham. We referred to him earlier. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 12. These stories are here for a reason, to remind us to consider. Genesis chapter 12. So Abraham and his wife heading down to Egypt. Verse 11. Came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt, Abraham said to Sarai's wife, indeed, I know you are a woman of beautiful countenance. She was a real knockout. Therefore, it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, they'll say, They will say, this is his wife, and then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Verse 13, please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, that I may live because of you. So it was when Abram came into Egypt, and the Egyptians saw the woman, and they said she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commanded her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. Verse 17, but the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and get out of here. Go. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. You could call that a panic-induced mistake. You know, he wasn't thinking clearly, God's going to take care of us. No, he's thinking that they're going to look at Sarah and say, whoa, and they're going to get rid of me. And that was a panic-induced mistake, you could call it that, causing Abraham to tell a lie. And you know, Moses, let's go to Exodus chapter 2. Moses committed what you might call a well-intentioned mistake. It's like the term we use for people that are difficult to deal with. Well, he means well. You know, she means well. What's that mean? What's that really mean? Was this a well-intentioned mistake on Moses' part? Well, let's see what we read here. Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown up, he went out to his brethren and looked and saw their burdens. Looked around, he saw an Egyptian man beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And so he looked this way, he looked that way. When he saw no one was around, he killed the Egyptian and he hid him in the sand. Buried him. Got rid of him. There's nobody around. No one's going to see this. Bang, get rid of this guy. There, I stood up for my Hebrew brothers. Well, well-intentioned. He saw the fellow being mistreated, but he relied on his own power to deliver the Hebrew, and that led to a murder. That led to a murder. And he had to flee. And that was the beginning of some rather interesting years for Moses. All right, over in 1 Kings chapter 1, we see here a mistake of negligence. A mistake of negligence. 1 Kings chapter 1. First Kings chapter 1. And notice verse 5. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. He said, I'm going to be the king. I'm going to be the guy. Notice verse 6. And his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, why have you done this? You can't do that. You can't take it upon yourself. The father made a big mistake that cost plenty. And of course, the negligence was a lack of discipline. A lack of discipline. A lesson for all of us as parents. Different mistakes we made with our families. Whatever it might be. Panic mistakes, well-intentioned mistakes, negligent mistakes, we've all made them. We've all made them. Psalm chapter 31. We can look here and see Psalm 31. Can find some insight into how God responds to our mistakes. Psalm chapter 31. Verse 7. David says, I will be glad and rejoice in your mercy, for you have considered my trouble. You have known my soul in adversity, or you've known my life in trouble. You know me. God sees us exactly where we are. Nothing is hidden. We can hide things from each other, can't hide a thing from God. And how does God treat us when we make mistakes? Notice verse 8. And you have not shut me up into the hand of the enemy. You've not given me up to the adversary, but you've set my feet in a wide place. He does not reject us. He gives us room to grow, and he gives us time to learn. How much time do we have left to learn? How much time do we have left to grow? I don't know. I don't know. And the older you get, obviously the time is much diminished. I think about that periodically, as we all should get to a certain point in life. How do I get a whole lot better from here than I am now? I can't do it on my own. I'm going to need a lot of that mercy and that help, just the same as you. Verse 14. But as for me, I trust in you, O Lord. I say you are my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and from those who persecute me. So my life is in God's hands. And how much time is left? No idea. The enemy, you see, is the mistake that keeps happening over and over and over. And this is the thing that happens to people. There's certain things that just hang on. And I thought I got rid of that. And now it's back again. And here we go again. When's this going to end? We go through these cycles. You know we do. It happens to that's the way it affects humanity. Certain things affect all of us. We've got to be disciplined to work on. Verse 19. Oh, how that's what we have to wait sometimes for that deliverance as well, as I said earlier. Verse 19. Oh, how great is your goodness which you have laid up for those who fear you. The goodness that we want and need is only going to come from God, not from us. Which you have prepared for those who trust in you in the presence of the sons of men. How great is your goodness that you've laid up for those who fear you, which you've prepared. God does it all. All he wants is willing participants. Try harder. Work at it. Have a better focus. Put some effort into it. Make this year a better year. Have a stronger commitment. That's what he wants to see in all of us. That's what I want to see in me as well. But when we do make mistakes, there are three things to remember. Even if there's 103, I don't know. First, you're human. It's not an excuse. It's a reality. Very human we are. Second, we can learn from our mistakes. And third, you will recover from whatever it might have been. You will recover, and so will I. We'll bounce back. That's the verse 23 here, Psalm 31. O love the Lord, all you his saints, for the Lord preserves the faithful and fully repays the proud person. So be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all you who hope in the Lord. That's you and me. And as we continue to grow, as we continue to look at our Christian lives and all the opportunities we have for growth, and there are many, every minute of the day there's an opportunity to get better. You know, it's one of the things I say when I'm teaching or training our distributor people, when I train them on the product, sit down with a group in a room, and I tell them there will never be an end of opportunities to help people. So you've got an endless opportunity to take this product and do something with it. And that's just so true in the Christian life. There will never be an end of opportunities to grow, to get better, you know, become more focused, more committed. Never. We can all do a better job. How about growth through weakness? Think of all the weaknesses that you have and I have. Let's talk about yours. I don't want to talk about mine, okay? No. Many of us know what it's like to feel frail and vulnerable on occasion. It's not very nice. You know, in describing the human condition, listen to what one scholar wrote about humanity. Quote, being prone to sickness, we hurt. Being mortal, we ultimately die. Pressure wears on us. Anxiety gives us ulcers. People intimidate us. Criticism offends us. Disease scares us. And death haunts us. End of quote. Right on the money. There's only one thing our scholar missed. God's perspective. We can relate to all of those things and more, but we need God's perspective on human weakness. And it is our weakness that opens the door to strength that only comes from God. It doesn't come from us. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Second Corinthians chapter 11. The Apostle Paul, on occasion, pointed to events in his life that led to his phenomenal growth. Verse 23, 2 Corinthians 11, he says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths more often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten, I was stoned, I was shipwrecked. I spent a day and night in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of waters, perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, perils of the Gentiles, in the cities, in the wilderness, and also perils amongst false brethren, it mentions in verse 26. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Besides the other things, what comes upon me daily? My deep concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? If I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity. You might have expected Paul to boast about the churches he founded. All the marvelous things he did, all the fantastic sermons he preached, all the wonderful epistles he wrote, all the great impact he had on people, on the Romans, and this group, and that group, and that town. Now, growth through weakness, brethren. Growth through weakness. You know, psychological studies on stress, a lot of you probably are aware of this thing, they divide certain events that impact our lives into numerical units. You probably heard this. And they say if you have more than 1,000 per year, you've got a lot of problems. And they say death is a minimum of 100. It can sometimes be 200 and 300, depending upon the circumstances. Now you're really moving up there. They said that Christmas, this wonderful time of the year, so-called, is between 25 and 30 numerical points of stress. Job loss is set at 50. It just keeps going on and on and on with different things. They even have down road rage today because it's a very high rate, very high numerical rate for a very short period of time, but it still has a tremendous impact on individuals, and it adds up real fast. And the way people live today, it won't take long to reach 1,000. Maybe at 882, you got to go on Prozac. I don't know, whatever it is. Maybe it's on 50. Psalm chapter 46. Psalm 46. Verse says here in Psalm 46, in verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. We're not going to be afraid. Let the stress get to us so bad we can't cope. Notice how the psalmist closes out here in verse 10. He says, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. We have weaknesses, yes. God knows. Another writer picked up another little goody here. Another writer makes an interesting but accurate assessment of human beings. He says this, quote, in all of us, think about this as I read this, all of us, we have vast reservoirs of full potential, vast areas of great satisfaction, but the roads that lead to those reservoirs of potential are guarded by the dragon of fear. He says childish fears might be monsters under the bed or ghosts in the closet, but when children become adults, the fear lives on in a different form. Perhaps a career disaster, rebellious children to deal with, losing our mate, marriage troubles. The fears are just as real as the childish ones, end quote. How true that is. How true that is about the human condition. But again, they don't understand who fills the gap. God does. We've got all these things that go through our heads too. Only God can calm those waters, help us through it, help us to get focused, help us to have a better understanding, to be clear and understand exactly where our help comes from. Yeah, how many numerical units do you have in your life right now? You might think about it. Maybe you've got 100, maybe 250, whatever it might be. Psalm chapter 27. You know, David knew fear. Oh, he knew fear. Verse 1. And it was real. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Psalm 27, verse 1. Whom shall I fear? Which means he must have been faced with it. The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Two similar statements with obvious answers. Verse 2. When the wicked come up against me to devour my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. In verse 3, you know, there's an entire army, Saul's entire army, out to get one man. No place to hide. Though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. The war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. Verse 5. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. See, David had no place to hide. No place where he could really get away on his own and escape. God had to bring him through all of that. You'll hide me in his pavilion, in the secret place of his tabernacle. He shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock. And you know, down in verse 7, now we start to see some emotions coming out here. We see some heartfelt emotions, or some real feelings, whatever you want to call it. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, verse 7. Have mercy also upon me and answer me. When you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, Lord, I'll seek. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. Do not leave me nor forsake me, O God of my salvation. Nothing half-hearted about his petition here, was it, to God? Nothing at all. Verse 11. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a smooth path because of my enemies. Do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. That brings us back to the first point. We grow through waiting. David had to wait for God to deal with Saul. He could not do it on his own. And he resisted the fear and he stood firm. So can we. It's like this past week, family up in Barrie, we know, the baby, 2-month-old baby, she was out shopping with her two children, and she noticed the baby wasn't breathing properly. And so she grabbed the baby and jumped into the van, took off to the hospital. Kept the baby on her lap, jostling it and moving it because the baby was obviously struggling, trying to get breath, and she knew that. And she went through 2 or 3 red lights, got to the hospital, roared up to the emergency, grabbed the baby, ran inside and saying, "Help me, help me!" And the nurse was virtually, "Relax, kid, it's okay, don't, what are you worrying about?" And just a nonchalant approach until she saw the baby and saw the blue lips and realized that this is condition red. And so the baby's okay now. But that, talk about fear. Talk about fear. God intervened there and saved that little one. See? She had to deal with a lot of fear and a lot of trepidation, praying madly that God, fervently that God would intervene. But David stood firm and resisted, and so can we. Notice Isaiah chapter 49. How can I say that with any degree of assurance? Is that just my rambling? No, my silly rambling doesn't matter a hoot. It's what God says. Isaiah chapter 49. This made me think about this young lady with her baby. Can a woman forget in verse 15 her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yeah, surely they may forget, yet I will not forget you. That's an astounding statement. See, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are continually before me. That's how important you are to God. I've said that many times to you, those that have heard me speak. You see, life is not just something to be enjoyed, but rather it is a task each of us has been assigned. I've been given a job to do, and so have you. To struggle, strive, wait, learn, grow, overcome, and just keep adding to it. Someone might say, it would be a lot easier to grow if I was winning. I'm not winning anywhere. I'm not winning this battle. I'm getting ticked off about this. I want to win. Yeah, I know. I understand that. I want to win as well. Well, God shows in the book of Job that growing through losing has a more lasting impact. When you speak of loss, it can take on several meanings. Loss through death, close friend moves away, fire in your home, sudden unemployment. Whatever the loss may be, the feelings are just as intense, and it is our reaction and perspective that will determine if we will grow as a result of experiencing loss. I don't care what it is. Job chapter 1. God allowed Job to lose his children and all his possessions. Job chapter 1. And you know the story. Satan came and said, or God said, "You considered Job blameless and upright." Verse 8. Verse 9, Satan said, "Well, does Job fear God for nothing? You put a hedge around him. You protected him. You're helping him. take away some things from him and then see what happens. So some things started to happen, all right. Raiders came down, killed the servants, took away all of his cattle, burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. Other people came down, took away their sons and daughters. Great wind came down. House fell down on all the young people and killed them. By this time, enough bad news had come in verse 20. And Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He knew that there was something mighty happening here. You see, we know how Job responded to the loss. But did you ever stop and look at his wife's reaction? You probably read this before. Notice it over in Job chapter 2, in verse 9. He's sitting there, scraping the boils in the midst of the ashes. Verse 9, his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So, was Job's wife filled with bitterness and anger? Had frustration taken over in that short period of time? Had the gifts of God been taken for granted? Had they turned into her rights? The right to a big family, the right to money, the right to prestige in the community, which they had? I don't know. I don't know if that's the case at all. Interesting question, no? But Job said, "Do we accept only the good? What about adversity?" One thing we can learn about loss is this. Our major goal in life is not to be happy or satisfied. Sorry. I wish it was. No, you see, that does not mean to say that God does not want us to be happy or satisfied. On the contrary. But that's not the goal. The goal is to glorify God in all that we do. Job chapter 5. Job chapter 5. Verse 17. "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. For he bruises, but he binds up. He wounds, but his hands make whole. He shall deliver you in 6 troubles. Yes, in 7, no evil shall touch you. In famine he shall redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the scourge of the tongue, and you shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes." And surely destruction is coming on our land, on our countries. See, Job's not talking here about happiness and satisfaction. The path of obedience is marked by times of loss and suffering, which God allows. And over in Hebrews 5, verse 8, won't turn there. You know that scripture. It says that though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. That's quite a statement. And the story of Job was an example of the principle that perspective determines growth. And through the trial and loss, Job came to know God and himself in a much more meaningful and much more realistic way. Philippians chapter 3. Only 75 more scriptures to go, those of you who are keeping track. No, not really. Just a few. Philippians chapter 3 and verse 7. "But what things were gained to me, these I have counted loss for Christ. Yes, indeed, I also count all things loss for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, that I may gain Christ, and be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which is from God by faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, suffering together, being conformed to his death, if by any means I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. Not that I have already attained, or am already perfected, but I press on, that I may lay hold of that for which Jesus Christ has also laid hold of me. I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forget those things which are behind and reach forward to those things which are ahead. And I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward calling of God in Jesus Christ. What a man. Over in Romans chapter 5, I have an interesting observation here. Well, they're all interesting, but some more so when you're dealing with a specific area. Romans chapter 5, and verse 3. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance or endurance, and perseverance produces character, and character, hope. Now, hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which was given to us. So why keep persevering? Why keep persevering? Why continue to stand against impossible situations? Why keep on waiting? Why struggle with stress? Why struggle with mistakes? Why struggle with fears? Why struggle with weaknesses? Why struggle with this and why struggle with that? And temptations. And why suffer? Why? Why? Because that is the Christian reality. That is how character is formed. That's how character is forged. That's how character is shaped. That's how character is tempered. That's how character is polished. And within all those areas and more, the very life and character of God the Father and Jesus Christ are given maximum opportunity to be reproduced in us. It is the spiritual that is of paramount importance, even though we are so physical. We study, we pray, we obey, and God enacts the changes that we need to change, the changes that we want. Matthew chapter 7. Some of the most familiar scriptures and that everyone knows and understands in the church. Matthew 7, verse 7. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. Put some effort into it. You're going to have to work at it. For everyone who asks, receives. He who seeks, finds. And to him who knocks, it will be opened. It doesn't say it may be opened. It says it will be opened. Verse 9. For what man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, you give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, you give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him, who obey him, who worship him? Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. That's where they get the golden rule from, as they call it. I want to read something to you. My friend Darlene Mander gave it to me. She said I could call her a friend only this once. So maybe you've seen this. It's called the God Who Provides. It's the logistics of the Exodus. I don't know if anybody out there has seen this before. It mentions here, this just shows you the tremendous power that God has. Now, I had never looked at it quite like this. Moses and the people were in the desert, but what was he going to do with them? They had to be fed, and feeding 2 to 3 million people requires a lot of food. the people needed 2,000 tons, 4 million pounds of food each day. Think about that. Too much, or to bring that much food each day would require 3 freight trains each a mile long. They didn't have any rail out there, did they, in the desert? Going across? No, I don't think so. In the desert, they needed firewood to cook and keep warm. Each day, this would take 4,000 tons, 8 million pounds of wood, and a few more freight trains each a mile long. And, of course, they needed water. If they only had enough to drink and wash a few dishes, it would take 11 million gallons each day. And a freight train with tank cars 1,800 miles long just to bring water. Isn't that amazing? And then another thing. They had to get across the Red Sea in one night. If they went on a narrow path, double file, the line would be 800 miles long and would require 35 days and nights to get through. So there had to be an opening in the Red Sea, 3 miles long, so that they could walk 5,000 abreast to get over in one night. These people say this didn't happen. This is just a fairy tale. Each time they camped at the end of the day, they needed a campground two-thirds the size of the state of Rhode Island, about 750 square miles. They journeyed in the desert 40 years. Do you think Moses worked all this out before he left Egypt? Moses put his trust in God. God handled things every day for 40 years. If you think God can't handle your problems, think again. I thought that kind of fitted in here. When a problem comes along, we can react in a very positive way, and we can watch God provide. And we can watch God part our Red Sea for us, whatever it might be, and lead us across to safety. One last scripture. 1 John chapter 3. Well, one last scripture in the last 520 I've got left. 1 John chapter 3. verse 22. And this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as he gave us commandment. Now he who keeps his commandments abides in him, and he in him, and by this we know that he abides in us by the Spirit that he has given to us. You see, brethren, God says, prove me. God says, try me. God says, test me, and I'll provide. As we can move forward here, brethren, as we must move forward. When these days of unleavened bread are concluded this evening, life is going to provide many, 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 many opportunities for each of us to grow and to renew our commitment to the Christian life. Endless opportunities. What we need is a willingness to accept whatever comes. We need to have the strength to face it head on. And we need the determination to stand firm. And the insight to see God's hand in all that we do.